But welcome, everyone. Sorry, our guy's late. Well, he's not late. He didn't get a link because apparently I didn't send him a link. Well, I will introduce him while I'm waiting, I guess. I don't actually know how to say his name. I can't remember who gave me his name. Jerry, I think, is his like short form, but Gerald, he's a licensed clinical therapist guy. I don't know what LPC stands for. Gerald's enjoyed the privilege of serving patients in a psychotherapeutic setting for several decades. His professional career began in the field of child abuse, and later he ex addressed both sides of the equation, abusers as well as victims. He's got several different books. He wrote a book about oh shit, sorry, didn't mean to cuss. He's written a book called Sexual Abuse in America. He's also written a book called we went back and forth so many times. He's also written a book called Awakening the Healing Soul and one called Transcending Trauma, and one called Ancient Ethics. He does all kinds of stuff with restorative action, or what do you call that? The thing that the Native Americans used to do with the circles. He knows a lot of stuff about that. We kind of went around and around about all the important information he says. He talks about the Ojibwe tribe in Manitoba, Canada, Hollow Waters. He's been to that reserve many times over the last 30 years, and he observed their restorative justice work in action. While that program has changed dramatically in recent years because two of its leaders have passed over, and it's not getting as good of funding, their model is brilliant, humane, healing, and cost-effective. Hollow Water staff have traveled to my Sheridan, Wyoming office to share their healing ways with sexual assault victims, and they have come to my current home in Des Moines, Iowa to lecture on this subject. He just knows a lot of stuff about restorative justice. He said, one other topic that is important to me is pedophilia. I want to address it as a sexual orientation, not a crime, just as I would refer to heterosexuality as an orientation, but not as a crime. Most child sexual abusers, sex abusers are heterosexuals, and we owe it to children as well as people with a pedophilic orientation to do some prevention work by reaching out with understanding and even compassion regarding what drives their abusive choices. Anyway, hopefully he'll be here soon because I think I've said all the things that I know about Gerald. Sorry for the not being ready for the guy. Hopefully he's almost here. Jane. Oh, I'm doing the thing again where I s use their names, but it's okay. This is the part that I edit out, so it'll be fine. I don't have to start saying real things until the guy gets here. And seriously, I've just had a rough week, so you'll have to forgive me. Sorry for wasting people's time. You can't make this go any faster, right? Like if you hadn't gotten this link yet. He just has to be patient.
Oh, and
I don't know
I
what.
was muted. You couldn't hear me. I was talking, but you couldn't hear me because I was muted.
I could not hear. There's no way to make this any faster, right? Like you can't like make his message from Zoom come any faster than it already did.
Or how did you send it?
Well, I sent him the email that I send to everyone else, which I swore I sent him last week, and told him, click the link, fill out the form. Maybe I should call him.
There he is.
Yay! Hurrah, hurrah. All right. Hey, Jerry, I'm so sorry about that. I really thought I saw my busy week coming up. Okay. All right. What is happening now? Is Jerry here? We said yes. How do you know that he's here?
Did I see him?
You can see him. How come I can't see him?
Well, I've got four at the top, four on the next row, four on the next row, and four on the last row. And he's in the last row on mine. Might be different on yours.
I can only see three people.
No.
I don't have any idea what's going on here. Well, hey, Gerald, I don't know how to say your name. Can you unmute him? I can't even find him, so I can't unmute him.
Disappeared.
He disappeared. Hurrah!
Dropped off.
Rats. How frustrating.
Must have had technical difficulty.
I guess so. He's not answering the message. We'll call him back. I don't know what to do here. Maybe message. Are you having technical difficulties? We saw you on for just a few seconds. Dropped off. I don't know what to do. You want me to tap dance?
That's good.
I'm not a good tap dancer. I don't know what to do. Do we trust that he's going to show up again in a second?
I guess he's sending him a message, right? So,
Well, he sent me a message that said, first, he said, "Is it Tuesday or Thursday?" Someone had told him it was Thursday, and I was like, "No, it's today. It's today."
yes, he's on again.
He's on again.
So,
Oh, there he is. Okay, hurrah. I'm gonna unmute him. All right. Hey, Jerry, we are so sorry about the struggles. I really thought I took care of this earlier this week. I'm a private math tutor, and so the month of May is called All the Kids Need Help at the Same Time, and they want to cancel all the appointments. It's very annoying. Anyway, I introduced you while we were waiting for you, so now it is your turn. You're unmuted.
Well, I should
You're
tell you
up.
why I'm late. I didn't have the invitation. Then I got the
Yeah, sorry.
invitation
My
and
bad.
it wouldn't work. And then I got through the invitation, but then my computer started making a buzzing sound and said, we have to reconnect you and restart you. Just round and round and round it went.
That's the
But
kind
finally,
of
I'm
day
here.
I've been having.
I thought maybe I'd call you and ask everybody to start a prayer group or something, but is that Charlie from
There's a Charles, yes.
Charles from Kearsarge? Nope.
Maybe.
I think so.
That sounds right.
Oh, okay. Good. Now, do you have my face?
I don't have your face. You got to click the little button that says video.
Yeah, I clicked it. There we
There
go.
we go. Oh, that's right. Welcome.
Gosh.
Anyway, before you got here, I read some stuff about you from the internet and from our correspondence. So consider yourself introduced and go.
Well, if you mistyped my name and misspelled my first name and made it Gerald, like a
No,
Germanic name.
I know there's no D at the end, and I didn't know how to say it. So can you
Yeah,
tell
because
us how to say your first name?
Gerald. But
Gerald.
if you clicked on Gerald Blanchard, it comes up with a story about Canadian criminal psychopath. And that gives a description. I have to reassure people, I'm not Canadian yet.
No, that was not the story I told.
Okay. All right.
I told him all about your restorative, you know, all the stuff about the Ojibwe restorative justice thing, and then I told him the name of at least four of your books, and then I just started tap dancing, waiting for you to show up.
Okay. Yeah, I don't work a lot much anymore in the field of sex abuser treatment, although I did for a long, 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 long time. But I've also worked with, victim treatment. And then I came, of course, to the realization that, oh, maybe the abuser is also a victim, and around we go. And now, and I thought I was a pretty good therapist for quite a few years, only to discover the role of MDMA in the treatment
Oh.
of trauma. And then I realized how inept I was previously. Even though people maybe said nice things about me and said they were getting good results, nothing was quite as effective as working with victims who were under the influence and the guidance and help of MDMA.
Really?
Yeah, and I've taken a controversial position. I don't know if Wayne is online here, but Wayne knows that I've talked about somehow we got to get this into prisons. And we got to help people who are captured and kept there and in civil commitment departments where in agencies where no one graduates because the treatment might be inept or we fear the label that the person has been given, namely pedophilia. So someday, and I'm just planting seeds right now, we got to think about doing research in prison settings with the so-called treatment resistant, uncooperative, untreatable sexual abusers who just may need a different approach. And you probably mentioned one of my books, The Difficult Connection, which I wrote a long, long time ago before our field was really open to the ideas. But it talked about how we connect with people we don't like when we don't like the things they've done, and our society doesn't like the things they've done. How are we going to change them if we don't know how to connect? Because relationship and connection is at the core of everything. So I wrote a book on that, and it was quite controversial for a while. And then I followed it up with a book by somebody I saw on your website, and that's Robert Freeman Longo. Together, we wrote a book
Oh.
called Sexual Abuse in America back in the 80s. And what we were s some of what we said, most of what we said back in the 80s was pretty good information, pretty accurate. But boy, it gets outdated so fast. And one thing that doesn't change, though, and I was hoping to talk some about this tonight, and then I'll let you redirect if you so like. I'd like to talk about pedophilia and what it is and what it isn't. And I must say, we're living in a culture that will read factoids and paragraphs, but we don't particularly like to read books on complicated and lengthy subjects like pedophilia. My foundational argument today, tonight, is that pedophilia is a sexual orientation. It's an attraction to minors. And we tend to think of pedophilia as being in this culture as synonymous with child molester or sex offender. And we don't do that with other orientations. Like, I'm a heterosexual, but I don't have to say that on my license plate or have it posted on my front door, dangerous heterosexual lives here. Just because I'm heterosexual doesn't mean I'm a sex offender. If I'm was homosexual, if I'm bisexual, if I'm asexual, if I'm, you know, there's a lot of orientations and confusion about orientations that don't necessarily mean I'm a danger to society, but it may mean I'm hated by and judged by society quite often. So I'd like to start with that somewhat provocative definition of pedophilia as an attraction to minors, an actual orientation. And some would say, some of the men I've, and there are women who are pedophiles as well, but some of the men I've talked to would say, I was born that way. As long as I remember, I always was fond of children, but when I hit 12 or 13, nothing changed. And I didn't like supposedly grow out of it. And at the same time, they would say things like, I sure as heck didn't pick it, because who would choose, especially in this society, say, I'd like to be a pedophile so that people will hate me, so that people threaten me with violence, so that people will prejudge me, that people will put me in prison, the slightest indication of anything I've done wrong. And then when I've done my time, put me in a civil commitment program, which I won't graduate from because nobody's trained in treating pedophilia and understanding it fully. So if I can't connect with my therapist at any level, I guess I'll have to wear this label all my life. And what it is, it is an orientation for life. So this idea that we once had, and it wasn't that long ago, that if I said I was a homosexual, then I would have to find a conversion therapist who would work some magic on me and change my orientation, and then the world would be better off. Because remember, it wasn't that long ago we concluded homosexuals were child molesters. They were just out, you know, on the prey, lurking, you know, ready to strike, like time bombs, like pedophiles were thought of as time bombs, ready to go off at any moment. So we came up with all these ideas of how we're going to protect society from this group of people. And of course, in this day and age, we thought technology, like tonight, technology, not my fave, but technology was thought to be the answer. So I'll get a, you know, a satellite hookup, and I'll get ankle bracelets and monitor where this person under probation or parole is. And if they're within so many yards of a daycare center, a library, a school, a church, we'll have to swoop in and arrest them. Now, there's quite an assumption that's behind that. First of all, that you're not going to be able to be rehabilitated. That's wrong. We'll get to that. But it's also that, are these people intellectually disabled, that they would go purposefully, if they wanted to molest a child, would they purposefully go to a school or a church or a library to do it? And so our idea of protection is to monitor their footsteps and where they've been and where they're going. What a waste of time, what a waste of money, what a waste of resources. So there's a lot of things we've done, and I'll get to them more and look at the converse of it, what we can do that's effective as well. But I'd like to tell you that it's a very small number of individuals. We've really surveyed men more than women, a very small number that ever go on to sexually offend. But boy, that's where we put our focus. But the most dangerous group of child molesters are heterosexual males, adult heterosexuals. Just look at the numbers. That's the group that molests children. If we're putting our binoculars on the wrong people and watching them and scoping them, we're not going to learn much. So that's important to understand. And a small portion of people with pedophilia diagnosis who get convicted of sexual offenses, it's an extraordinarily small number. And then what we've said is of those that they're untreatable and they just go out and reoffend. But you know what? We don't have numbers that back that up. We don't have numbers that back that up. Now, this is really edgy, and I feel a need to say it, though. If that person was ordered to a prison treatment program and had staff members who are grossly underpaid in the prisons, who get no, and they only get generic treatment on, they call it sex offender treatment, the legal term, rather sexual abuser treatment being a little more appropriate. But if they don't get better, we conclude, say that's an untreatable group, and then the Supreme Court says, yep, you're right. Frighteningly dangerous group of people. Now I'm going to introduce a word, though, that's important to know. It's called iatrogenesis. Iatrogenesis. I-A-T-R-O, genesis. And what that means is sometimes the treatment is worse than the original problem. More serious problems are generated by inept and incompetent treatment by healthcare agents that creates more problems than the original presenting one. It's like how we treat depression these days. You know, antidepressants work about 20% of the time. 80% of the success with antidepressants is from the placebo effect. But we keep using them and using them and using them. And we know that if you stay on antidepressants long enough, they cause depression. So is it that this person just isn't working their treatment program? Do I need maybe to switch them over to another SSRI and another and another and another, and then maybe slip in a mood stabilizer drug too, and maybe an anti-anxiety drug, and more addictive drugs, and they don't get better? Maybe the problem is more than just with the individual. And this is not my way of saying someone who commits a sex crime should be left off the hook. I'm not saying that at all. But as professional people and concerned citizens, if we want our society safer, then we have to understand the people we're working with. I just pulled up some quotes from men I have worked with who were pedophiles and were willing to talk and just appreciate what they had to say for a moment. One fellow said, who among us would ever choose this attraction? I mean, it's just, everyone knows it's beset with problems and heartache and pain. And who would want to set out to harm children? That we don't just make a choice like that. Even, you know, your heterosexual child molesters don't make choices like that. They fall into a pattern. Another fellow said, I didn't ask for this. Who the hell would? Was his question. Another one said, I feel like I was born with this orientation. Still another, I never grew up after age 12, he said. I never grew up after age 12. Still another said, my attraction feels morally wrong. I must be immoral. Now, when I discovered I was heterosexual, I didn't immediately conclude, I'm going to assault somebody and I'm immoral. There are confusions, of course, but nothing more than that. Still another man said, if I were to publicly announce who I am at the core of my orientation, I would certainly risk being physically assaulted. So, of course, the implication is I better keep this all a secret, handle it on my own, at home, not tell anyone about this, and somehow I'll get better. Maybe I'll find something online that'll help me, and that something online might be porn. One more man said, I explore who I am online, often on pornographic sites. And from my being distant from the field for a while, but one thing I noticed, and this is, I go back in the 80s, one thing I was lecturing on was sexual addiction. And what I found is that if people, men or women, were doing something that went against their morals, and they knew society wouldn't accept it, they had to keep it secretive, sneak to do it. And that gave an extra buzz, a level of intensity to their actions. And eventually it can become an addiction. A colleague of mine from Denver once defined addiction. You know, you think of sex, think of drugs, think of cocaine, Budweiser, all of it. But he said addiction can be defined as the excessive use of pleasure and excitement to obliterate our emotional pain. You know, he didn't say, oh, you become an alcoholic because you're dehydrated or whatever. No. We got emotional pain that's not being addressed. Well, what if that pain is pedophilia? What if I go online and I start using porn a lot? And the porn industry has quite a knack to watch what you're looking at and then up the ante a bit and up the ante a little more, up the ante a little more. And by definition, addiction is a problem that escalates over time. The compulsion, like OCD, might be something we do the same way over and over and over again. But addiction grows more serious with time. Boy, but then if I got to keep it a secret, that implies I've done something wrong and I've got shame. Well, what feeds an addiction probably more than anything else, including a sexual addiction? It's not testosterone, it's shame. So we look for a mood-altering experience to get rid of our shame. And then eventually maybe somebody gets arrested and it's in the newspaper and it's on their license plate. It's tacked to their front door. It's in the sexual registry in their community and statewide with the worst possible photograph taken at the PD. And what do they get? Constant infusions of shame. So we lecture them and we threaten them to get better. That'll work, sure. And it's as nonsensical as conversion therapy. You're not going to change this orientation. It's permanent. It's fixed. But there are things we can do in response to it. So if we're going to be helpful with individuals afflicted with this sexual orientation, we've got to listen to them. Be quiet. Stop our shaming. Invite dialogue. Make sure it's a safe circle of support. And try and let them know we're trying to understand them. And I think of one of my college profs, Helen Perlman. Somebody asked her, what's the ultimate job of a psychotherapist in helping someone? And she turned it to the audience and asked them, what do you think? And they said, we have to understand who we're dealing with. And Helen Perlman said, wrong. She said, we have to try our damnedest to try and understand them, even if we don't like them. And people will see that effort, that attempt to try and understand. And then they might feel safe enough to reveal who they are, what their thoughts are, what their fantasies are, what their attractions are, and what their behaviors include. But we got to create an environment that's safe for people to come forward. So what are we doing these days in that regard? Some good stuff. There's two national hotlines you can call, two national organizations. I hope people are aware of it. But if you know someone who's a pedophile, and I must say, I just got a phone call the other day from a pedophile. He's gone to therapy. He told the therapist it just frightened her. She got scared. She says, I can't work with you. I feel like I must do a mandatory report on you. And he said, why? I haven't offended. She said, well, it's the ethics of my, you know, social work schooling that I have to report you if there's a danger to others.
Yeah. And we've had that happen in multiple places where you go in, you haven't done anything, and they still turn you in.
Yeah. So the dangerous place may be the therapy center. So the first one of the first groups of people we have to get to is the pedophiles and let them know how to be good shoppers, good consumers for therapy, get to their families and let them know the difficulties with this. Not any generic therapist, you know, is trained in this or, you know, is comfortable with this subject. But then we also need, back to my point, to let them know that there are national organizations designed to help. Two of them, I'll tell you about it. One is B4U Act. They were founded maybe 22 years ago, still around. And then more recently, I think it's an offshoot of Before Your Act. It's VIPED, V-I-P-E-D, VIPED. And I think they even have more people that they're helping than Before You Act. VIPED means it's short for virtuous pedophiles. Now, we used to say the worst pedophiles are the kinds that say they're virtuous and they're helping children. They're introducing children to sex and giving them a tender and a caring way to experience their first sexual encounter. And so they've co-opted that. They've stolen that name. And they call themselves virtuous pedophiles because they want to promote positive ethics, values, and virtues among each other. So, you know, it used to be queer was a pejorative term. Now it's just taken on by people to express their orientation. And even in the pedophilia circles, there's some of that going on as well. So we're trying to separate out here two things, attraction from action. You know, the action is built into the word attraction, but just because you have an attraction doesn't mean it'll lead to an action. How many men do you know of or have heard of who have gone online and witnessed and watched porn or gone to movies where there's sexual assaults and they find it exciting to watch that? But do most of them go out and offend? Probably not. Does that mean I'm pro-porn? No, not at all. I think it's dangerous, especially if you're already isolated because of who you are. And then you get hooked on this intensely pleasurable and exciting thing, sex. Forbidden sex, even more exciting. Got to sneak to do it and keep it secret, more, you know, intense it is. Now, what if I decided while I do that, though, I should really have maybe some cocaine or maybe some liquor that I can drink? You know, another dose of pleasure along with my excitement. So I get both pleasure and excitement from sex, maybe from alcohol, and we merge the two. Pretty soon we've got an addiction. And if it's an addiction to sex, now we have something that can escalate. And I just spoke to someone today in therapy with a sex addiction, and I was asked, or I said that wrong, but it doesn't matter. It's somebody who knew a sex addict and wanted to help him. He said, how do they think? And I said, there are really four core beliefs that everyone will, a sex addict will have, but even more exaggerated if you're a pedophile with sexual addiction. But to be the core belief of a sex addict is, number one, I'm a bad and unworthy human being. I mean, that's just in there, lodged in. It's part of their identity. The second core belief is, nobody could love me just as I am. I have to be changed in dramatic ways for anyone to find me likable. But kids seem to like me, adults not so much. And then the third core belief, see if I can remember these now. I can't depend upon other people to meet my needs, because when they find out who I am, find out more about me, whew, it gets ugly. That's the end of that friendship. Then I'm in the gossip circle. And the fourth core belief is, sex is my most important need. There's so much of a connection between sex and pleasure, and sex and pain reduction, sex and mood alteration, that that is my biggest and best friend, my most reliable source of comfort. And I will go back to it and go back to it and go back to it if I'm a sex addict. So if we're going to talk about sexual offenses, we also need to talk about sexual abuse in people's backgrounds. We need to talk about pornography use. We need to talk about societal's reaction. We need to talk about, are therapists ready to deal with this? And a lot of people, when they show up in therapy, are asked this question: were you sexually abused as a child? From my experience, pedophiles, I don't know, not any more than most other people. It's not as if they got locked into what happened to them as kids any more than a heterosexual would. That's not really where it's at. This is something you were born with, and you quickly become a victim of hate crimes. And some people say, well, people who become sex addicts almost always were sexually abused and physically abused. Yeah, indeed. But there are other ways to get there, other ways for that to happen. And sometimes with a constant reinforcement of orgasmic pleasure and excitement and all the sneaking and whatnot, not only does a person get addicted to sex, but their biological and their neurological template becomes fixed in place. It's like now we develop a biological and a physiological, a neurological component to this. We can even carve out new brain pathways in this addiction. So then I go find a therapist, maybe let's say a pastoral counselor. How much neurology do you think that person might know? How much would they might they know about sex addiction and how to treat it? So this is a complicated matter, and it behooves us as community members, behooves politicians, people at the cop shop, people in prisons, people in therapy offices to know much more about this subject. And then when somebody comes in the door, do we label them because of all they've gone through as PTSD? You know, it would give them that diagnosis. Might fit, but what I find is that almost minimizes their experience, because it's been so long that they've endured trauma, so chronic, that we tend to then use another word that's loosely defined, complex PTSD, for the most severe types. And what I say to that is, that's not enough. That's not strong enough language. And I think what we've got here is a lifetime situation that has a very poor prognosis because of the world they live in. They suffer from a post-traumatic stress issue. I call it post-traumatic stress injury. And it's a lasting thing, just like the pedophilia is a lasting thing. So you just don't shake it real easily. A Zoloft won't make it go away. You know, a tranquilizer, a Valium won't make it go away. It'll just subdue it for a while. So this is more serious than PTSD, more serious than post-traumatic stress, more serious than post-traumatic stress disorder, more serious than complex post-traumatic stress disorder. This is a world of pain for somebody to live in. Now, should I be very sympathetic then and let them off the hook for what they've done if they've harmed a child? No, but I better find them the best damn treatment I can if I'm doing a report for the court or anyone else, or any mitigation report at the time of sentencing. I really have to be an outspoken advocate for masterful treatment, comprehensive treatment. So then let's say somebody shows up for treatment. And most of you, through the introduction, know that I've worked in the restorative justice field. I've been influenced so much by the Ojibwa people at Hollow Water First Nation in Manitoba, Canada. There's a women's organization there that was working to combat sexual abuse. in the tribe. And I went up there. I heard some about them from a prosecutor there, who was a friend of mine. And the prosecutor felt it was just shallow how the government, the crown, as they call it in Canada, the federal courts, were dealing with this. Immediately, you were taken out of your community, sent to a white psychologist out of town, sent to a prison with predominantly white people, and then you went into a generic sex offender treatment program that's very systematic. We all do A and B and C and D. It's the same format for everyone. One size fits all. That didn't work. And the group of women were willing to meet with me at Hollow Water, Canada. And I sat down with them, thanks to the door opening by the prosecutor, who gave up on the court system and refused to prosecute anymore. The women said, first of all, I sat down with her and said, like, how many of you suppose have been sexually abused? And they looked at me almost dumbfounded, like, huh? I said, you know, child molestation, sexual abuse, what percentage of you experienced that? And they still looked dumbfounded. And finally, a woman named Burma Bushi, just an incredible woman, said, Jerry, we all have been. That's our experience here. And if we left the community and were sent to a Catholic boarding school, most assuredly we were sexually abused there, got no treatment after the priests molested us and the nuns beat us, came back to the community, and then we molested here and got arrested, and then were sent to, they said, the Holiday Inn of the South, which was Stony Mountain Prison. And I said, the Holiday Inn of the South? And they said, yeah, the women said, that's where you can go and have people cook for you. You don't have to work. They always keep coffee brewing for you. You can play cards and look at porn. That's called prison. And they said, we're going to fight against sex abusers from our Hollow Water community going to prison. First, we must circle up with them. First, we need an admission. We need the court to guarantee they will postpone any hearings until we've worked with these people for a while. They have to meet with victims who are now trained as circle supporters. And the victims would have the same. And then eventually the groups would merge as one. And furthermore, the women said, and we're sick and tired of these white judges being flown in who know none of the people involved, none of the perpetrators, none of the victims, and they have the same sentence they give to everyone. What would be wrong with having someone locally who knows these people in our community make some determination? So they argued with the prosecutor quite successfully, and the conclusion was the community would sentence the men in their community. And they were some of the most novel sentences of all. Like one guy, the first man that I saw sentenced, 200 people showed up for his sentencing. This is only a town of maybe 600, 800. 200 adults showed up for his sentencing. Depends on who you talk to, but maybe one or two. I think it was two people recommended prison. No one else did. They were under the influence of the women who said, they've hurt our community, now they must do good for our community. So here these men were out walleye fishing, sent out to the into the lake to walleye fish and deliver fresh fish to elders. And the elders looked forward to them knocking on their door. The fish man is coming. And they'd be small talk and they feel like they're doing something productive. But if you were an elder, you got the cheeks of the walleye first. Other people could have the fillets. But if you're an elder, you got first dibs on cheeks, which is like the tender morsel from up in the cheek of the walleye. So it was an entirely different way of envisioning a solution to this problem. So now, you know, there were pedophiles there. There were heterosexual child molesters there, rapists, all kinds of men. But they treated most of them all in the community, and they just didn't re-offend. They were in the embrace of the community. Here, we'd prefer to beat these people up, lock them away where we don't have to see them, talk to them, learn about them, address any of their concerns or issues, and that heals nothing. You get bitter people coming out who are going to reoffend. So is it by nature of the crime they committed that makes them a risk to reoffend? You know, most child molesters, even those that go to prison, don't reoffend. It's a quite a small number that do. But what if they got the most up-to-date, comprehensive, sensitive treatment? So if you're a pedophile and you go to treatment, well, what would that include? And one of the things is promoting child safety. We want to talk to them and brainstorm with them, like, how can we keep kids safe in our community? And you'll find that pedophiles have a lot of opinions and a lot of ideas on it. And when you get them together in a group like Before You Act, that's what they're talking about so much of the time. What can we do to advance child safety? There was a program back in the 80s. Fran Henry started it. It was called Stop It Now.
Mm.
It was a prevention program. What a concept. Why don't we prevent it? But no, in my hometown, what we did was he said, after a child has been sexually abused, we need to teach them to yell and run and tell someone. So the child's got to take care of themselves after an assault. And I was thinking, why don't we consider spending some time on prevention? And that's what was being done at Hollow Water. And that's what we want to do. And that's what men in these two groups that I mentioned do. They spend a lot of time talking about how can we prevent children from being hurt? And secondarily, keep ourselves out of trouble with the law. And it's someplace we can go to and talk about the dangers of pornography. And along with that, we need a therapist who's comfortable then talking with a pedophile about their masturbatory practice. No one trained me for that at university. How do, you know, nobody said, ask about this theme. But you know what we did in the 80s? And we're still doing it across the country. We want to know what pedophiles and child molesters are thinking and aroused by. So what a lot of people do is they hook them up to a gadget called a penile plethysmograph, and it measures blood flow in the penis. And then your agency buys some child porn, isn't that thoughtful? And then you show the child porn, these images, and watch the blood flow, and the meter records it in their penis, and like, aha, now I know what you're turned on by. Where do these therapists buy their porn? And why are they showing it to these men and calling it treatment? And is it really a blood flow issue anyway? And I know I lost my audience one time at a national conference, American Association. Well, I'll leave the name out. Never mind. I was in front, I was asked to give a speech there about effective and ineffective methods of treatment. I was talking about the penile plethysmograph. And I said, sometimes what we do is we even put tubes up the nose of the pedophile. And if they show excessive blood flow in the penis, then we shoot aromas, noxious aromas up their nose, like ammonia and dog poop. And so I said, I'd like to know from you people in the audience, where do you order your porn from? Do you just get your ammonia at a store? What about dog poop? Would you collect it? And then how do you get it up their nose, the smell of it? And what they were thinking was, well, if we associate something really negative with arousal, the arousal will change. No, it's a sexual orientation. You don't change it with dog poop and whatnot. So the penile plethysmograph was a machine that we have historically and still use, sometimes even still use lie detectors, which are notoriously inaccurate. But the penile plethysmograph in front of this audience, this national audience, I said, how many of you have a Black and Decker pecker checker in your office? Okay, a little bit sarcastic, but that's me. And they roared with laughter, but it made them recognize that it isn't a gadget that's going to save children. It isn't blood flow. It isn't dog manure. It's, you know, we were professional people charging well over $100 an hour to do that to pedophiles, thinking we were being constructive. So we're going to have to change that. So somebody gets to the counseling office now. We got to be able to ready to talk about their masturbatory practices and the themes to which they masturbate. Like, am I in control of it? Am I forcing it on someone? Is it mutual? Because a lot of pedophiles have started there when they have sex with children. They started out very affectionately because they have this emotional bond that's strong with kids, but because they can't connect with the adult world who hates them. But then the natural outgrowth of the emotional connection sometimes is sexual arousal. And that's when the trouble sets in. So we have to talk to them and get comfortable talking to them about their masturbatory habits, the themes behind them. The next thing we have to talk to them about is examine the pedophilia as their primary source of their personal identity. Remember the core beliefs of a sex addict? I'm a bad and unworthy person. Nobody could love me as I am. I can't depend upon other people to meet my needs. Sex is my most important need. Well, their whole identity then becomes their pedophilia and anything they've done wrong with it. So we have to talk about identity. And it's too superficial to think of it as just self-esteem and get them to feel perky and nice about themselves. No, they need, this is a word we teach them, demonstrable efficaciousness. In other words, they have to demonstrate that they're effective in managing their orientation and protecting children. And then they start feeling good about themselves. And then when they're in a group of other people doing the same thing, they've got some collegiality. They've got some socializing. They're not so isolated. So that's the next thing we want to talk to them in therapy about is their social withdrawal and their social isolation. Boy, a lot of pedophiles just spend a lot of time at home alone. And I did research in three prisons on things that are associated with sex addiction. And I thought I was really smart. And I thought, I bet I know the number one cause that behind someone who's molests a child. I said to myself, it's rejection. So I delivered hundreds of surveys to prisoners who were incredibly cooperative and sharing. What I learned was that most dangerous top two things that seemed to precede and trigger an assault were idle time. We called it unstructured time, yeah, but time with nothing to do. Idle time is dangerous. Grandma told me that. Idle time is a devil's handiwork, she said. And she also said, anything that tastes really good is bad for you. She had that kind of advice. But the other thing that was number two on the list of what triggers acting out was isolation. After a while, we would like some human contact. Even if we're a pedophile, we still want human contact as a pedophile. I say we, it's not that I'm a pedophile, but that's how I would talk with them. You're one of us, you're a human being. We all need people in our lives. So we got to make that therapy environment inviting, comforting, and thoughtfully confrontive. I can't be afraid to ask the tough questions, but I will ask the pedophiles I've worked with, I got to know how to confront you if you're doing or saying something that leaves me very uncomfortable. And I say, tell me what's the best way to do it, the best kind of words to use. And then when they were doing something questionable, I'd say, remember that day when we had that conversation about how you wanted to be confronted if you were on dangerous ground? I said, I'm going to do that now, so I hope you'll hear me. Well, when the method came from their own mouth, they're going to listen. Eventually, I evolved that concept from confrontation to something I called carefrontation. We can have, out of care, say, I'm concerned for you, concerned for your welfare. I don't have to do scare tactics. You're going to hurt a child, you're going to harm a child, you're going to go to prison. No, we begin where they're at and show care for what they're grappling with if we're going to make a difference. To expect somebody in a world of pain to have marvelous empathy skills ain't going to work. And yet, that's one of the number one things sex offender treatment programs work on, empathy building. For the most part, it's a waste of time. They have to get to know themselves first and then draw from that to understand other people. But they need feedback from other folks, particularly feedback from people who share the same orientation, the same worries and fears. Then another thing that one would have to deal with in therapy is help them consider what they're developing as a sexual identity and their sexual activities. Is it just porn? And are they going to become asexual? Is that their choice? I'm just going to do away with sex. I hope I don't offend people with this one, but look at how that worked out for the Catholic Church. If you deny, 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 saying give up sex, never ever act on any sexual impulse, you're going to get sued how many times? And the church will become defunct because we tried to cure the problem by denying human urges. Then the next thing we did, the same thing we do with pedophiles, like the Catholic Church, what do they do historically? If somebody gets convicted of having sex with a church boy, an altar boy, they historically have done a geographic cure. In other words, you just move them. And typically, we moved them to New Mexico, to Arizona, put them in more remote areas, and who knows what went on there. But we've done the same thing with child molesters, sex offenders of all types. A geographic cure. And like Burma at Hollow Water Reservation said to me, we're not going to send them to the Holiday Inn of the South. They're going to stay where and see the harm they committed. They're going to feel the guilt. They're going to see the harm they've done. And then they're going to, and what happens is then they have trouble re accepting kind care. One of the sentences that a judge gave a man who molested his children, beat his wife, beat up a Royal Canadian Mounted Policeman, he did it all. And one of the things he was court ordered to do was deliver the fish. And then he had to get into a card group with other men. So community people had to sit with him and talk to him and play cards. And then the community was part of the court order. They ordered the community to do things, these women. And like one of them, this guy, he lost his driver's license. So he'd walk from where his therapy was down this gravel road, it was maybe 2, 3 miles to get home. And it gets mighty cold up there. And the community was ordered to honk their horn and wave whenever they saw him. to acknowledge his existence. The women thought of this because they wanted to be acknowledged for their existence and not to be confused with being soft on crime. No, it's about humanizing people by treating them as humans. What a concept. So I really marveled at those, the women there and what they taught me. Then the other thing we want to work on in therapy is emotional relationships. It doesn't have to be sexual. We all need intimacy. How can you be emotionally close to adults, even if you're a pedophile? Well, most of us can be emotionally close to people of any age. So let's work on that with them and give them some skills on how to talk about who they are without revealing too much. Not having to lie, but not having to confess with everybody you meet, you know, what your orientation is. But to try and figure out safe places, maybe like church groups, circles of support. A lot of inmates and prisoners have these, and that's necessary. But then here's another thing we want to work on with them, their own stunted emotional development. Many, many pedophiles I worked with are not really skilled at socially relating to adults, but can be really good at it with children who are safe and admiring and look up to them and who are fun to be around. But we got to help them get those needs met with other adults and so develop them out of their stunted emotional position. I was in a prison once in Wyoming, and I was asked to come do an evaluation on a man who had been incarcerated there for sex offenses against children. And I listened to his story of his life, and I don't own a DSM, and I will never buy one again. Because a man, an elderly man at the Hollow Water said to me, and I'll come back to this guy in the prison, but he said to me, "What is that Bible you all carry? You know, the one with all the names you can call people?" He said, "We don't let our children do that. Name calling is not allowed." And he said, up there in the North Country, he said, "Don't some of these names stick? Don't they just freeze people in their identity?" I go, "Yeah." He said, "Tell me, why do you use that?" And I had to be honest. I said, "So we can get insurance payments." And then he said, "So wait a minute, you have to be paid to care about people? What a concept." And then he said, "What about these jails you're kind of into? You like caging people, don't you?" He said, "You know, I had a dog once who barked and barked and barked and barked, big dog. He was so kind, but the neighbors felt he was dangerous. So I built a kennel behind the house and I put him in that kennel, and he was such a good dog." He said, "I kept him there for as long as I could, and it was just hurting his spirit. And he was just begging to get out. And one day he bit me. I was the cager. Before that, he didn't want to bite me. I was not rehabilitating him. There was nothing to habilitate him to." So he said,
"Did it make the dog stop barking?"
I don't know about the barking. I honestly don't know the answer to that.
That doesn't seem like that would make anyone stop barking.
No, but barking meant he was dangerous to the neighbors.
Oh.
So we got to lock up this loud dog, and he's a big dog, who was just, you know, warm and lovely. And he'd go in to visit him, and he would just beg and cry and whimper to get out. Because when the man wouldn't want to go out, and he was pushing him back into the cage, and the dog bit him. And that's how people come back sometimes after prison. But I'm in this prison by now, back to Wyoming. I'm in a prison in Wyoming, working there. And I'm visiting a man who had been convicted, incarcerated for sexual abuse of children, got his life story from him, took his social history. And what it reminded me of is what the DSM says, our Diagnostic Statistical Manual, DSM, which, by the way, if you say it, it means diss them. And that's what we do with people. We diss them. And I thought, you know, he sounds like an avoidant personality disorder. That's what this man sounded like. So I looked over at this psychologist's bookshelf, and there was a DSM. I said, "I'm going to get something, and I'm going to read from it." I opened it up to avoidant personality disorder. And that disorder, as we call it, a disorder, means people are not inclined to engage in intimate relations with people unless they're given very strong reassurances that they'll be met with acceptance, and where there's little risk of rejection. And so they isolate and they withdraw and they avoid social contact that makes them uneasy. It becomes a pattern. Well, avoidant personality disorder really fit him. He said, "Let me see that." And there was a, you know, DSM, everything's by a checklist. So I put the psychologist DSM in front of him, and he saw the headline on it on top of the page, you know, the chapter title. It said avoidant personality disorder. And he said, "Do you have a pen?" I said, "Yeah." I handed it to him, and he scribbled out disorder, and he wrote pattern there, avoidant personality pattern, Don't diss me, he was saying. It's a pattern that he was willing to acknowledge he fell into, and he only felt really comfortable with young people and children who would adore him, not so much with adults. So that's another thing we want to address in counseling. But still a final thing, and then I want to kind of open it up to the people there, or you, Dan, whoever might want to ask questions. I don't even know how we're doing on time.
We've got a half an hour. We're good.
Okay, we're good. But another thing that has to be addressed in therapy is suicidal risk. And two studies have been done on this, and they're reported in this book. I don't know if any of you can see it, but it's called A Long Dark Shadow. It's all about getting to know pedophiles. A guy from Old Dominion University wrote this book. His name is Alan Walker, A-L-L-Y-N, Walker. And he interviewed several hundred pedophiles and just was accepting and listening and gathering data on them. And he also talked to somebody else who'd done something similar. And they asked how many of the men had ever seriously thought of suicide. And it was quite diverse. The first study done on it was 10%, you know, were suicidal. Then Alan, after getting to know these men, put a survey in front of them. And they must have felt safe to open up. It was close to 75% said they had periods of suicidality. So we better talk about it. And we better get comfortable with suicide and not go, oh, my God, oh, my God. I need an EMT, I need the ambulance, I need this person hospitalized. What they probably need is human connection. I tell you, if you're an addict or you're depressed, what you really need more than anything is human connection. And if that comes in the therapy office where you're met with non-judgmentalness, but honesty, helpful guidance, carefrontations, you got a better chance of working something through. And that's what we have to ask of our local mental health centers. Who specializes in pedophilia? And they might say, well, we don't work with sex offenders here. And you say, I didn't say that. I wanted to know if anybody works with sexual orientation, pedophilia. And immediately you got some education happening. And they may say nobody, okay? But you've done your little piece of education. Even if you sent a note to the mental health center saying, I know someone with a very different orientation. It's called pedophilia. Do you people deal with it? Could you offer support to these people? And if they come back and say, well, we have a sex offender group, you say, I'm not asking for that. I was asking if you have a supportive staff members who work with pedophilia, but just like you would with somebody who might be homosexual, a lesbian who wants somebody to relate to that understands them. We don't necessarily conclude that they're all going to go out and sexually offend. So that's one way we can do some education in our community and get them thinking about that. And if somebody does provide that, oh my goodness, that's good news to be spread. If it's a solid person. So it's, you know, how do we make a difference? That's why, and it's still another way is you can have your circles of support. You know, as it were developed across Canada and then came to the US, we got trainers in the US like Kay Pranis and others that go around the country and provide this training. She's been here repeatedly to Des Moines. When I lived in Wyoming, she repeatedly came there and did training. That's just what she does. And she has a friend who has a publishing house in St. Paul, blocking on it right now. But they just sell books on restorative justice. And boy, is that healing for both sides of the equation. And it's really hard work and long, painstaking work to get ready for bringing perpetrators of crimes brought together with the victims of crime. But when it does, oh my goodness, the difference it can make. And after Kay trained us in Wyoming, she said it'd be good to maybe start with like shoplifters at Walmart and have them sit down with the manager or something and work with the manager to be good about it. Maybe they can do some giving back in some way. You know what? Our first case we handled was a guy who killed his girlfriend when she was about 19 or 20. And he went to prison, a prison program that I developed, which now they've moved away from because it's too soft on crime in their mind. But the parents were getting training in restorative justice. And they wanted to talk to someone who had murdered an individual. And this is going to sound almost beyond belief, but what happened is they ended up sitting down with the man who murdered their daughter. And it's hard for me to tell you about it right now because it just chokes me up, because there was so much care and compassion in that room both ways, because the circle training got them so well prepared. And this man felt he didn't deserve any kind treatment from anybody for the rest of his life. And in come these parents saying, we'd like to understand what happened. And he told them everything and they listened. One thing led to another. They had an empty apartment in their house. When he got paroled, they let him live with the parents. They invited him to live with them. I mean, talk about restoration. This was more than restoring him or rehabilitating him. This was creating a whole new human being in him because he was met with such loving compassion. But he also knew from prison, you're not going to get by with brutal things. But when all the facts were understood of what happened and the parents heard it, they had a different impression of things. And because people had met with this man who had murdered, I didn't say murderer, I should say the man who murdered. When people had met with him week after week, month after month, they really felt like they knew him and knew he was honest, knew his motives were good. And that's when they said, we're ready. If the victim support circle is ready, we'll bring the two circles together. And what did they do afterward? Much like they did at Hollow Water, Canada, a feast. Everybody feasted together. A round, large loaf of bread was passed around. Everybody tore off a piece and tore bread and broke bread with one another. I started doing that in my office as men would graduate from my sex abuser program. It made people in the office building a little uncomfortable because they could smell prime rib and garlic wafting through the air vents in the building. And one of the men who was a baker who was in the sex abuser group, and he'd bring in pies. And we had this marvelous food and a graduation feast to, get this word, to traumatize the abuser in a good way. Because we say that there's two kinds of trauma, good trauma and bad trauma. A good trauma is one, a trauma means something unexpected, big, powerful, life-altering happened to you. But nobody said it had to be always negative. So in the backgrounds of many of these men, there was trauma, and we worked on it. But then when they graduated, we would give them a feast and cause a positive trauma. We said to pave over the original trauma. And then the final thing, we put a gold medal around their neck, not just any gold medal, because I had the good fortune of going to the Ali Center in Louisville and working at the Muhammad Ali Center. And Muhammad, got the gold medal in the Olympics. And what he did there, the people did there, is they'd make gold medals that looked like an Olympic one with red, white, and blue ribbon. But on the back of it, they would engrave the top five values that a person wanted to live by and had demonstrated they lived by. And when they graduate, I bring these ribbons. And by surprise, the men usually, there weren't too many, back-to-back graduates. So it might surprise someone to see this come out and they get this hung around their neck. And walking out of the building, their tummy full of baked beans, roast beef, cherry pie, and feeling good about themselves. And boy, was that controversial because it sounded like we were trying to reward criminality, trying to prevent it. And doing for others as we have done to ourselves, the golden rule. But sometimes there's a platinum rule, a higher order. Do unto others as they would have you do unto them. The golden rule, do unto others as you would have them have people do unto you. That's about me, 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 me. What about the platinum rule? Do unto others as they would like done unto them. We'd teach that, and then we'd do it to the men when they graduate. Get to know them, get to know what they need, and seem to find ways to provide it for them. Then when they get out in the community, have a circle of support around them to check up on them. People will say, hey, let's go to Perkins for coffee and breakfast. Meet you there. And if they didn't come, then the circle would go to his home. What's up? You okay? Okay, so that's kind of my philosophy of things, but can I open it up, Anne? To you or anybody's
Absolutely.
root
Yeah, no, I
question?
loved everything you said.
Okay.
That was
Thanks.
great. And honestly, if people just treated each other well, like sure, of course, if you grow up your whole life knowing that something you think is hated by everyone around you and you can't talk about it to anyone, but you can't change it, of course you're gonna like lose your mind and do just
You might grow up to become president.
I can't disagree. Okay, so we do have some questions up here. John had a question, which he says he direct messaged you. If a psychologist, psychiatrist, therapist, etc., in the course of treatment admits or even talks about attraction to minors, perhaps the person has never acted on these impulses, but the professional's mandated to report. Yeah. This is a dilemma. This is it, every single state has a 50, every one of our 50 states has mandated reporter. So yeah, like you can't tell your therapist, you can't tell your friends, you don't have any friends if you tell them.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Well, Many states have the language that says if you even have reason to suspect. So maybe there's a denial. I never did it. You know, I told the therapist I've never done it. There's never been a criminal investigation of me. But because I say I'm a pedophile, some people say that's reason to suspect. And I'm saying, you know, we can try and educate politicians to change all that. They're not gonna. That's, to my mind, that's not the way to go. We work with our mental health agencies and train people, and we work with our child protection staff, train them to know these some of these distinctions I'm talking about. That's where we can make a difference. So then reason to suspect doesn't mean, oh, so you're heterosexual, that means you're going to sexually offend, and say, you know how nonsensical that is? Well, similarly here, just because someone has a different orientation doesn't mean they're pre-criminal. You know, what if they're trans? Oh, dangerous group, right? Dangerous, dangerous. You know, we've got to educate people that difference doesn't necessarily mean danger, and attraction doesn't necessarily mean action. That's what we hammer home. Yeah, we've got a lot of adult men in this culture of ours who are working hard to protect themselves from ever being exposed. So I think of that line from Macbeth, a Shakespearean line that says, "Methinks thee doth protest too much." Some of the loudest, most critical voices sometimes are the most guilty. And then those who are compassionate, well, they're confused. They're charged with fomenting criminality and promulgating criminality. So we just have education to do. But we don't educate by screaming and yelling a lot, really. We can get mighty, mighty angry over the injustices we see. We alienate the group we're trying to change. And I have that knack. I've been told by my fellow professionals working in the sexual abuser field to overstate my case, sometimes thinking they all think like I do. Not necessarily. So, you know, I came to this organization thinking, you know, given what your name is, that there might be a little bit of open-mindedness here. So I'm speaking with as much, I'm being my authentic self.
No, I'm 100%. I mean, I don't know that everybody who's a member of WAR is as open-minded as I am about this, but like what we're doing isn't working. We've been doing it for years. It isn't working. You know, so many of us have had have experienced, you know, sexual harm as kids, and we don't have a good way to deal with even that. So if something happens to you, you know, my issue, I didn't tell my mom. I knew sh I was. Like, we didn't talk about sex in my family. Everything was shame, 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 shame. So I didn't say a word. As an adult, one of my cousins like came out in the family and said she'd been abused in my family, known for this. Like, just people sort of half understand, like, don't send your kids to grandpa. He's not for watching kids. And when I heard my mom talking about my cousin coming out, she said, "Oh, that happens to everyone. Get over it."
Yeah, it's a
Like,
phase. It's a phase.
it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so if you don't let people talk about the things that happen to them when they're kids, they grow up and no, we're not dealing with it on, you know, at some point we're able to have a little empathy. Like if I had told you when I was 5, you would have empathized. But if I don't tell you when I'm 5 and then when I'm 50 I do something bad, now you have no empathy for me anymore. We gotta, yeah, it's dumb.
So we
Beverly,
have.
I know Beverly's gonna have some good questions.
And I just will say quickly in response to your talking about what's effective, we got to do what works. And I'll just quickly go back to one of my first professors of psychotherapy. He was a piece of work, and I really liked him. But we had an 8 a.m. class at St. Cloud State University on psychotherapy, and it was scheduled at 8, and that's a cold town in the north. And I'd walk the class, and the first day in the auditorium. He said, "So here we are at 8 a.m. to talk about psychotherapy. I don't know about you, but I sure don't want to be here at this hour. Who scheduled this?" But he said, "If you can make it to every single session, let me just tell you in 5 minutes how to be a therapist. Because there's only three things you have to say to every patient you see, and then you're a therapist." I said, and of course, I was like, "What are those three things?" He said, "One, ask every patient, what have you been doing? Then secondly, ask them, does it seem to be helping you?" And he said, "You don't have to say anything in response to us. Just set them thinking, what have you been doing? Does it seem to be helping?" And he said, "You're a therapist." And I'm like, "Dr. Glasser, Dr. Glasser, you said there were three things. We have to ask every patient if we're going to become a psychotherapist. And I said, you didn't mention the third thing. And he went, oh my goodness, what's your name? And I said, Blanchard. He said, Blanchard, okay, I'll say the obvious. The third question you ask them is, did you bring your checkbook? And he said, it isn't all that much more complicated. You got to help people look at their behavior and ask them if it's helping. And if there's another choice that would be more effective, it's all about efficacy. I'm back to that again. You know, and when they're doing something effective, we jump all over it and say, way to go. Brilliant. Brilliant. Keep doing that. Glad you thought of it. Reinforcement. Yeah. Versus judgment. Somebody had a question you said or hinted at?
Beverly.
Hi there. Thank you so much. I am astounded by this because and I put this in the chat that I have a son in prison right now. And he wrote me a very, very, very long letter about what he said was his philosophy. And in that, he basically gave me his history of his sexuality. And it started when he was a young kid, about 11 or 12. And when he and his friend were having sleepovers, and so they were both the same age, and he said that his friend initiated caressing with him, and I had no idea that this was going on, you know. Unfortunately, at one point in time, they did involve his sister, who came and told me, and that's how I found out about that incident, and I banished the friend away and grounded my son. And then when we got computers in the house, he started watching porn whenever nobody was around. That got him pretty involved in that. And then my computer started acting up, had my older son look at it, and he saw all the porn that was going on. So once again, we banned him from the computer. We told him, you know, grounded him, told him this is not acceptable, this is inappropriate. Never once did I ask about why are you doing this? Kind of like, what have you been doing? Does it seem to be helping? And, you know, and trying to understand him. So anyway, I am hoping to continue this conversation with him. And he hasn't had many relationships with adult women. He was in one, at one point in time, he was in kind of a long-term relationship, but that was just before COVID hit, and he was starting to isolate himself, and he started drinking and going online, and he found the furry community, and
he needs
felt
friends. He wanted love.
Oh my gosh, yes. He even came home and told us about the furry community, and I had no idea. And he said, I have found my people. And so anyway, I am not sure what to do with all this, you know, what's going to happen when he gets out of prison. I wish that I had have known this beforehand so that we could have avoided all this and understood him before, and to be able to tell him, you may be attracted to minors, but you can't act on it, and try and help him develop a better way of making relationships.
How old was he, Beverly, when you caught him with a daughter or whatever?
Oh, that was when he was like about 13, maybe.
Yeah, so
12 or
yeah.
13.
He's 11 or 12. He's just still figuring himself out. He's attracted to another 11-year-old. Totally reasonable. He's 12 or 11, and then if from then on it's shame, shame, shame. That's what I think we do wrong.
Oh yes,
Jerry, you answer.
But
sorry.
Well, Beverly, I think one of the things you can do, because it's never too late to be helpful here, is, and you can be helpful by trying to understand. Remember that quote I said? It's not that you will understand, or your goal is to understand him. You will really fervently try to do so. Well, how can you do it? You can take some notes from tonight that you maybe have kept, or ideas you kept, and say, I heard this guy talk the other day on Zoom. He was different. And I never heard anybody talk quite like him. And I want to, would you be willing to, if I could tell you, son, what he said, and I'd like to know your reactions to some of this. You might
Yeah.
open up a dialogue that would be rich, and he might feel that you really understand him, and you rekindle a strong relationship again, or begin to rekindle it. It won't happen overnight, of course, but
Yeah.
you ask him what he thinks about this topic, and then he'll ask you back, why were you listening to that guy anyway? And you say, well, because I want to learn about people, I want to learn about you. I always care and always will. And
Yeah.
so see where that goes with him.
And I plan to do that the next time he calls, and I'm going to he and I have decided that we're going to write back and forth to each other. Obviously, we can involve his father, to read letters back and forth too. But my husband doesn't seem to really want to do that. And so
Yeah.
I'm going, okay, whatever.
But
And
your comfort level, Beverly, your comfort level is good enough that you would be here tonight and you would be a part of this meeting. And that's who he needs to start with. Somebody with a
yeah.
reasonable level of comfort, this subject, who's not gonna go ballistic with
Yeah,
anything
and the
but
other thing, Beverly, if you haven't read if you read Harmful to Minors, I think I've talked to you about this book before. This book talks a lot about how the way that we deal with kids and sex
oh
doesn't
yeah.
actually work, that it's
Yeah.
the opposite of what we want. And when I read that book, it let me rethink what happened to me as a kid and like, oh, yeah, he was only 3 years older than me.
Yeah.
He wasn't trying to hurt me. He was learning. He was going from being a non-sexual infant to a sexual adult, and somewhere in there, we screw up. We do dumb things. We don't know how to ask. We don't know how to wait for an answer. We think, oh, I'm bigger than her, so I can just hold her down. Well, like, we make mistakes. And when I read that book, I was able to just sort of like rethink what had happened to me. And if you read that book and let it help you rethink the way you thought about what when your son played with your daughter, like, oh, they're just dumb kids doing dumb stuff. If your daughter came and said, my son bit me, well, you'd be like, oh, we don't bite. And then,
Yeah.
eventually nobody grows up and bites.
Yeah,
But we
true.
don't do that with
So
sex.
yeah, so I do plan to continue this conversation with him. I am very open-minded about looking at it a different way, looking at it as an orientation that's popped into my mind. Maybe this is an orientation, but then you kind of want to say that and ask other people about it. But that it's really not something that people discuss. And also, you don't want people to start saying, well, then you approve of it. Well, no, I don't. It's I'm trying to wrap my mind
We're trying to
around
find a better
this.
way to deal with it because
Yeah.
what we're doing isn't working.
Yeah,
There's
and it's
got to be
very
a better way, and I think restorative justice is finding a better way. They're having better results.
Yeah,
And love is always a winner over hate.
and what we're doing, I believe, is really inhumane. And the way that the good trauma and the carefrontation, I mean, duh, and your stories about the Indian tribes and the way that they handle people that they know. The whole community knows about this person, but yet they keep them in the community and they get them to do things for the community. I mean, that's brilliant. It's brilliant.
The language
Yeah.
my friend Burma used up there at Holowater was she said, we want to keep them in our embrace and keep them out of the Holiday Inn of the South, but keep them in our embrace.
Yeah. I love
And
it. I don't know if my family will go along with what I am thinking of, doing and all that.
Well, Beverly, I would seriously consider having your family watch this video, right? I
Okay.
mean, I've gotten a fast way to edit them now, so when it's ready, it won't be that long. I mean, maybe. This is, I think, the conversation the world needs to have, the whole world.
Yeah, I think so too.
All right, this guy
I think.
Daniel
Thank
asked a
you.
thing, asked
Thank
some
you.
questions a little bit ago, and we haven't called on him yet. If he's still here, ooh, what happened?
Are you out there, Daniel?
I don't know what happened. I did some kind of crazy thing, and now I can't see anything, and it's all weird.
I see
Okay,
it.
anyway, he didn't answer me, but he says, What are the clinical outcomes of incorporating MDMA into the therapeutic treatment process? Has ibogaine or other psychedelic compounds been used in a clinical research setting of this kind? I am fascinated with this answer. So,
Familiar with them all, and also ketamine as well, and other things, ayahuasca. When I have real strong feelings about which medicine we use, a lot of people group MDMA in with psychedelics. It is not a psychedelic, it's what we call an empathogen. And what it does is really helps you focus in on relationship problems you've had in your life, from trauma, interpersonal abuse, and the like. And you don't hallucinate, you don't go to Mars, you don't see aliens, but it makes you much more compassionate, heart-centered, and your thinking becomes so much clearer. I just finished with a man in his treatment. It started yesterday and we finished it today. And he was under the influence all of yesterday, and then he had his integration today. He was a victim of sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, spiritual abuse. You pick the abuse, it's happened to him. But what I like about it is you stay grounded in reality. You have your good mind with you, but you have two parallel realities you're working with. One is just a fresh new perspective on relationships that this drug gives you. This is a relationship drug, just like, I don't know, Buffering could be an arthritis drug. It goes for to your elbow or your knee or something. This works on a slice or two of your orbital prefrontal region of your brain where we form our relationships, we read people, we develop empathy, and people come to realize that, hey, maybe I didn't invite that abuse that happened to me. Maybe I was a part of something that was just normal sexual exploration as a child. Maybe I hurt people I haven't even thought about and I got to talk about today and right now. And so they never lose reality. Reality just becomes clearer under that medicine. And people call
wow.
it a psychedelic, it is not. Now, when it comes to ibogaine, you mentioned that one's kind of iffy. You got to go to Canada or Mexico or Costa Rica to get ibogaine, which is an African herb, and it gets made into a synthetic drug in India and shipped to Montreal and checked for purity and then goes to other locations in North America. But we tend to use ibogaine with powerful addictions like opioid addictions, heroin addiction, because it stops your craving for heroin, for instance, in hours. And it stops your withdrawal sometimes in 36 hours versus weeks and weeks and months and months. But when you take that ibogaine, if you were traumatized in your sometime in your life, there's going to be a movie playing for over a day. And you will see what happened to you in vivid detail. And it might be horrifying, it might be painful. It might be just an incredibly difficult experience that led you to your heroin or cocaine addiction or whatever. And then when people come out of treatment, they're almost always crying when they come out of their treatment room a day and a half later, 2 days later. They come out of their treatment room crying, and they're always saying the same thing where they're crying. When they're crying, they're saying, "I'm so happy. I've never been this happy before," because they got it resolved. They went to that deep, dark spot that they were afraid of. And this something lifted them and it just brought tears to their eyes. Other people go down to Peru and other places around the US to get ayahuasca. Okay, that's a root or a vine, I should say, a vine out of usually comes out of the Amazon, and we're chopping up the Amazon to get all of the vines sent to the US because US wants everything. And it's a hallucinogen, and it'll make you vomit. You'll probably lose bladder control, bowel control, maybe when you're using it. A lot of your trauma from the past might rise up. I've sampled it in my I've journeyed to the Amazon. I go around the world studying shamanic cultures and medicine people. I've tried it. I can't say I noticed much of anything, but boy, some people were having really powerful reactions. The thing about ayahuasca is somebody's chopping it in the woods. They're making it in a kettle. They're mixing another element in it called chacruna. You don't know quite the strength, and everybody just drinks out of a shared cup, and you don't know how much you're getting. That's not precise. And sometimes people have become psychotic after ayahuasca treatments. So I'd rather use something like MDMA for trauma victims where it's really predictable, hour by hour, what's going to happen. And then there's other things too, but psilocybin, magic mushrooms can be really good with severe anxiety and depression. And we use it, Johns Hopkins University uses it with people who are dying of cancer and really fearful of death and they're dying. And they take what's called a heroic dose. They give you a heroic dose, a large dose of it. And synthetic, you're not chewing on a mushroom. They give you a synthetic version of it. And you have a horrific few hours, 6, 7 hours. It's just scary, really scary. And I know one fellow who went for that kind of treatment. He was a financial planner. He held on his job somehow. But after work, he'd always like gin and tonics. He'd go to this one bar, and the bartender, they filmed his story after it at the bar he'd go to, because the next day after his treatment, he never has drank again. It just stopped his addiction. And the bar, they're sitting at the bar, and he said to the bartender, "Line up how many drinks, one after the other, in glasses behind me on this bar." And you could see with the camera this long, 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 long row. And he said, "That's how much I'd have each night." He said, "I don't have any urge at all." I've seen the same thing happen with people with smoking, with psilocybin, but also when there's a fear of death, sometimes that fear of mama dying or daddy dying puts the whole family into a tumult. And so when the dying person takes psilocybin, they just get comfortable with their passage. It just can kind of neutralize it for most people. And what happens then is the whole family calms down, and the passing can be a loving moment. So different medicines for different issues. Don't be buying, getting stuff off the street. You don't know what you're getting. MDMA is oftentimes loosely referred to as ecstasy or atom or Molly. It ain't. It's referred to as a psychedelic. It ain't. What it is, what that is used for trauma treatments, is a professional, clinical, research grade, measured, pure, guaranteed safe. And that's what we give people. Your buddy from Chicago doesn't pull up and say, "I'll meet you behind Kmart," to open your car window and throws in a baggie with some pills in it. Now, this has got to be done very professionally, and we're getting pretty free and loose with it in the U.S. right now. You know, as open-minded as I
Really?
am, yeah. Oh,
Really?
you can get anything in here. And this is Des Moines, Iowa.
Well, I
Yeah.
mean, I know like I can get it illegally. What I'm asking is, are they letting therapists use it? I
There's
mean,
an
I know places in St. Louis, like we have a psychedelic society with a, you know, we have people who talk like you're talking and people who are doing it, but I didn't think it was legal.
It's not legal. MDMA,
Okay.
what was to be FDA approved last year, and at the very last second, they pulled the rug out from underneath it. It went through all phase three trials. It had approximately 80 something percent success rate in eliminating symptoms of PTSD. And then the government said, "Nope, can't have it."
Yeah, they want us to buy all the things that the companies are selling stuff. They want us to buy fentanyl and, you know, Adderall and all their nonsense. They don't want us to be able to take things that have been proven to be helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And MDMA is legitimate. Trust me on that one. I hope you'll trust me on that.
Oh,
But
I trust you in all of them. I
the
was a
source.
member of Make Marijuana Legal organization when I was a kid, and I've got a like war legalized drug. I think drugs should be legal. I think it's dumb that they're not.
But the sourcing is really important. Legalizing is another
We could
thing.
do better if
Well,
we could,
I do believe.
if we made it legal, we could be more careful about that, couldn't we?
Yeah, we could monitor the safety of it. You know, but I don't know if we'll ever do that. But you know, difference right now, even believe it or not, Iowa is thinking of legalizing psilocybin and having some sort of monitoring agency that doesn't try and follow up who's using it and getting in trouble, that's like, but just making sure the product is what
Yeah.
it's said to be and it's not contaminated.
One of my friends is lobbying, or I think she's done, but was lobbying the Missouri legislator to try to get psychedelic some things legalized for veterans
Yeah.
because it's been shown to be helpful, and she really was working on. I don't know how they're coming, but.
All veterans with PTSD have heard of MDMA and they want it. And interestingly, cops want it. Cops who have been involved in dangerous situations, shootouts, and that sort of thing, they too get traumatized. You know, I don't worry, let's say, if I'm treating someone, if a cop's going to show up and say, "What are you doing here?" And if I were to say, treating somebody with trauma with MDMA, and he's like, "When can I make an appointment?" I mean, that's kind of what you expect from police and from MD and veterans these days. And most therapists nowadays know of it, but and a lot of people just have experienced some of it on the street, and they think of it as an aphrodisiac and sex drug and party drug. And when it's pure, clean, given a proper dose, proper setting, the setting made sacred or very reverent, boy, people grow They just have unbelievable growth. The fellow that walked up today was just so content, so happy.
That's awesome. All
Yeah.
right, I want to be careful of people's time, but I just think you're fascinating, and I could literally listen to you another hour just talking about this. Let's let Daniel D ask the last question. Daniel, do you want to ask it with your hand up, or you want me like you want me to unmute you? I don't know how to find you, Daniel. Okay, you're unmuted, Daniel.
Thank you. So I'll just read what I had dropped in the chat because in my, I'm not going to call it research exactly, but basically in my interactions with certain communities where I've discussed the efficacies that I'm aware of around ibogaine. By the way, this information about MDMA is new to me, so that is fascinating. I would absolutely sit in on another session to dive deeper on that. But some of the knowledge that I've picked up about ibogaine stuff, psilocybin, these kinds of things being used in a clinical or semi-clinical healing setting. I have run across a lot of pushback from, I would say, people that are basically, they were new agers, and so they were really deep into all the, all the bright and shiny stuff, and then typically became Christians and have thrown their weight completely back against these kinds of compounds and basically saying, these are a portal to unhealthy spiritual influences that just it kind of blows the door wide open. And I think that there's some substance to that, but my concern is, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. My concern also is, as I think Anne mentioned, what we're doing right now ain't working and has not been working. And I don't see a lot of people coming to the table with a rational, reasonable, and clinically efficacious solution of their own. So to those folks that are sort of on the religious right and have influence, over some of these agencies that make decisions, what would be, I'm curious what your response would be to them if they say, well, the Bible says don't do drugs while they're, buying everything that their pharmaceutical, stock options make available to them.
Okay. Daniel, thanks for that question. A couple of things. I'll try and remember the different parts to it. One of the things you said early on, though, is in my language, I would say there's a lot of enthusiasm about psychedelics, and we call them entheogens, and then MDMA, which is an empathogen. And there's entactogens. We got all these names for these different types of drugs, but they all get lumped together these days by the a lot of young people who just think they're all just wonderful, they're all life-saving, and there's a lot of rush to positive judgment about them without considering, like the example I heard today of a guy who took so much high THC marijuana that he became psychotic. And I had a similar case a few months ago, much like that as well. So we can't say that, let's say marijuana is good for everything or it's bad for everything, it's a gateway to hell or whatever. What we've fallen victim to, though, are trends and enthusiasm that looks at the success stories. And those are the ones you see a lot of online, but you don't hear people talk about some of their more difficult experiences with some of these medicines, including plant medicines. So I think we just need to be a little more objective, and I've caught myself being very charismatic about this subject, and I have had to cut myself back because not everybody has a favorable result, let's say from ayahuasca or something like that. And ibogaine can be a scary one. We've had some scary outcomes with that, but I think it has more to do with the clinical setting and the unprofessionalism and how it's administered. We don't know much about sometimes how it's sourced unless you're getting it in Canada. So there's that. Then you mentioned sort of the politicized religion attitudes toward this. Not every group wants to hear about science, and science has gotten a bad name for some reason. We're not trusting science and research like we once did and like we ought to. And we need some objectivity. We need hypotheses challenged, like all MDMA people jump off tall buildings, like Art Linkletter said of his daughter, and kill themselves. You get these anecdotes, and people run with them, and they can have They can politicize it and preach it and be righteous. And it sometimes props up their identity as being in the know and in the right. And this area of psychedelics and pathogens, it's not all one way, all the other. There are pros and cons with these things. And it needs a careful analysis. So when somebody makes a sweeping statement about it's the portal to Satan or whatever, I say, you know, like if they said psychedelics would lead to evil doing on your part, you have to ask them which particular psychedelic, synthetic or natural, in what amount, what kind of numbers are you working with? Is this a research project of one, an N of one, as we say? So the motive for promoting some of these medicines sometimes is oftentimes just to create an identity around yourself as being kind of modern and with it and in touch and brave and adventurous. And then there's another side that wants to be righteous and pure and godly and other things. And I'm just saying, can we just be honest and scientific and talk about all the pros and all the cons, and then make a decision if you want to use any of these in your life. But I just, you know, I've been around the block. I've traveled to many countries. I sat with many tribes, drank many fluids, swallowed many things. I drew my line at the cannibalism. You know, it's like, you know, I just ate, sorry, not hungry. But you know, I've seen how things are done. And when medicines and drugs, plant medicines are used well and have good results, it's when the set and the setting are designed well. The set meaning, what's my intention? What's my motive? Is this going to be done in a helpful way, or is this just recreational fun I'm trying to have? And then the setting is like the environment of yesterday, very reverent, in nature, sacred, tying his beliefs, his morals, his ethics into rituals we did along with the administration of the medicine. So that's setting. So why are you doing it? Is set. The environment you're doing it in is setting. If it's sacred and thoughtful, protective, and above all, safe, then I'm with it. I'm open to it.
Wow. Well, I have just enjoyed every minute of this. I could literally just listen to you all night. This is, I wish we could put this on like the world's speaker system and just like, seriously, guys, there's got to be a better way to treat each other than the way we're doing it. All right. Well, thank you, everybody.
Oh, thank
I
you.
gotta shut us off because it's 8:50 and I tutored for 3 hours today. I need to
all
go
right.
lay down.
All
I
right.
love you all. You guys have been great. Seriously, Gerald, I would love to have you back just to talk about this, or really any of you're fascinating. So I'll be in touch.
Well, thanks for the nice words. Okay.
All right. Love you guys, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. I can't remember 2 weeks. I told you how to save the chat in the setting. And I don't know. I'll tell you who it is next week when I remember. All right. Bye.
Bye now.